Hello and welcome to the PC Pro podcast. I'm Tim Danton, editor-in-chief of PC Pro, and apparently my microphone isn't coming through very clearly today, so I apologise for that. Maybe it'll improve. Who knows? Such is the excitement of live broadcasting. Okay, so with me today I have Darian Grahamsmith.
Hello.
Hello, who sounds crisp and cheerful. And also Barry Collins.
Hello, Tim.
And then a very special guest, tucked away in the corner, well, in Shoreham. Are you in Shoreham or are you in Brighton?
I'm in Brighton.
You're in Brighton. So we also have Paul Ockenden. This is the first time, I can't remember, have we actually had you on a live one before, Paul?
Not on a live one, no. It's a long, long time ago.
No. Okay, well, welcome to this exciting new era of the PC Pro podcast. All right.
Hello. And
but we're going to start off, Darian, with... some sad news, really, I suppose, which is the demise of Paul Allen.
That's right, yes. Paul Allen, co-founder of Microsoft, is no longer with us after tragically succumbing to non-Hodgkin's lymphoma at, oh, I should know the age, he was in his 60s, I believe.
65.
Oh, there goes the, well, there we are. So there goes the gravitas already, sorry about that. But no, he was, he's an interesting figure because, you know, for the whole of my life, I've been interested in computing and I've been following, obviously, I've been unable to avoid the rise of Microsoft. And frankly, the name Paul Allen has come up about zero times. He is not someone who is, you know, who has been intertwined on a day-to-day basis with the progress of personal computing, but he was pivotal in making Microsoft what it is today. Particularly because at the very, very start, when he and Bill Gates were at Harvard together, he was the one who said to Bill Gates, look, home computing is going to be a big revolution. You and I should drop out, move to Albuquerque, and start writing software for these new upcoming computers. And I'll say this, Mr. Allen must have been a very persuasive guy because Bill Gates was like, yeah, that's a good idea. Let's drop out of Harvard and move to Albuquerque. So that's what they did, and Paul Allen was with Microsoft for the first 7 years of its existence until the end of 1982. It doesn't seem, well, at the time, I think it didn't seem like a particularly friendly environment. I think Bill Gates was a bit of a workaholic, and he and Paul Allen reportedly would often have big arguments. And then Paul was taken ill. He was diagnosed with, I think it was Hodgkin's lymphoma. He died of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, but previously he had a different sort of cancer. And so he was missing, understandably, some of the hours of work that Bill Gates and other Microsofties were putting in. And as a result, Bill Gates, who, as I say, a bit of a workaholic, started to get a bit resentful. And there was talk of reducing the amount of shares that Paul Allen had in the company. He was negotiated down to 60-40. They're trying to push him further down, trying to buy him out for $5 a share. In the end, he voluntarily left, having hung on to his shares, and thus became a multi-billionaire. So that was probably a good call. But yes, after that, Paul Allen was a tech investor and personality, but very hands-off with Microsoft. I think he was actually – he remained on the board but not actively involved until 2000. And then after that, he severed ties completely. So a very instrumental figure in the history of Microsoft, but kind of an eminence grise rather than a day-to-day, you know, household name.
Yeah, and did you read the full personal reflections from Bill Gates about that he wrote about Paul Allen?
I did. Are you getting at something in particular?
Well, I'm just it wasn't gushing, is what it struck me. I mean, obviously it was positive, there seemed to be some kind of you could see there was some friction between the two of them.
Yes, no, it's clear. Yes, even in like Bill Gates's quite measured and as you say, quite positive eulogy, there's not much of what you'd call love. It's, I mean, but then again, I mean, Paul Allen also. I'm just like skimming down. I mean, he came up with the name Microsoft, and he was the one who negotiated the purchase of QDOS, the quick and dirty operating system. After, because Microsoft got the contract to write the operating system for the IBM PC, but they didn't have an operating system, so Paul Allen was the one who went out and bought one and made it happen. So I mean, he is, you know, Bill Gates, I think, really should be quite grateful to Paul for that. But I think it was Paul Allen, I think it was in his book, he said that perhaps the problem was that they were both working on the same stuff and it wasn't a Steve Jobs, Steve Wozniak relationship where one was marketing and one was technical. So it may be that it's a bit unfair to, you know, to, it's a bit unfair to say Bill Gates was the guy who made it happen and Paul Allen was, you know, just an ideas man or just a businessman or whatever, because there's more to it than that.
Yes. Well, and Paul, presumably, as you know, his namesake, you knew Paul Allen?
I think he's one of those guys that he's obviously, you know, multi billionaire. But if he was walking down the street, you wouldn't recognize him. If you heard him on the radio, you probably wouldn't even know his voice.
Which
is a nice position to be in, I think. I think he was quite comfortable with that.
I was just going to say, you definitely wouldn't recognise him as well if you only knew him from, as to be honest, I did until recently, only knew him from pictures of like the early days of Microsoft. And back then he had this enormous bushy beard and he was 2 years older than Bill Gates. But Bill Gates, I think, always had this baby face and Paul Allen quite the opposite. And I genuinely thought that when they started Microsoft, from these pictures, I thought this was some investor guy in his 50s or 60s who'd taken Bill Gates under his wing. The fact that they were at Harvard together was quite a surprise.
Yeah. I mean, what really strikes me, I think, is that he left Microsoft, well, before Windows. So that's a long, long time ago. So 1982. And he's been living with this cancer for 36 years. I think that's remarkable in itself.
Presumably he went into remission frequently. I don't know the details of the problem.
Yeah, I know. But I mean, these days, Hodgkin's lymphoma or non-Hodgkin's lymphoma are both sort of very survivable things. But 36 years ago?
Yeah, yeah. You know, that's probably why he needed some work-life balance as well.
Yeah. I'm sure the money helped as well.
I'm sure it did. But as they always say, health is the number one thing, isn't it? So, yeah. Barry, am I right in thinking that Paul Allen was involved with Southampton at some point as well?
I think you are confusing me with Paul Allen and footballer.
I'm sure there was a Microsoft billionaire philanthropist who was involved in some takeover at some point. Oh,
really?
I thought so, but maybe I'm.
I don't know. He was into sports, wasn't he? He was one of the. He had one. Is it the Seahawks? He's Seattle Seahawks.
Yeah.
He was the owner of. So, I'm not sure about investment in Southampton.
Okay, well, as I say, I may be making that up. And you know everything about football, obviously, as anyone who's followed your Twitter feed will know. So,
Paul Allen was actually a major investor in the Seattle Sounders FC. That was his soccer club, as they call it. Maybe you know, Seattle, Southampton, they do sound quite similar.
Thank you very much. I feel completely rescued from that now. All right. Anyway, well, I think it's right to mark the passing of someone who's had such a fundamental effect on computing as we know it. And just the oddity, as we've all touched upon, is the fact that just wasn't a household name at all. You know, even Steve Wozniak, who wasn't really actively involved with Apple for a very long time, everyone knows Steve Wozniak, and he's one of the great silent men, isn't he?
Well, I mean, his name might be better known to us if we followed the American sports. I mean, he really did kind of, you know, invest his Microsoft billions in the NFL and in I think it's basketball team as well, the Portland Trail Blazers. So he was, you know, he was active in his community, and you know, he wasn't a recluse. But yes, no. To us techies, sport is often a closed book.
Yeah,
he stuck a wad of cash into the SETI project as well.
Did he?
Yep. About 25 million quid he invested in that when they were looking for a telescope to try and find aliens, bless them. He was the one who stumped up the cash for it. Oh.
And South End Sites has piped up on Mixler to say he funded and co-founded the Jimi Hendrix Experience Museum, because he was a huge Hendrix fan, as we also discovered in the eulogy written by, or personal memories written by Bill Gates. So there we go. He definitely, it's safe to say he did a heck of a lot with his life, heck of a lot more than, frankly, I'll ever do. All right, so let's move on to the next subject, which is, the Facebook portal. Everyone aware of this, guys? Facebook portal?
No, sorry.
Sorry, what was that, Darren?
No, I'm not aware. Sorry. I'm on a little bit of a delay, so I don't mean to be speaking over you. It's just it's the technology I'm blaming. So sorry about that. But no, Facebook portal is another one of these buzzwords. I mean, I have heard it, but there's so many like Amazon branded and Facebook branded and Google branded things swirling around at the moment. Which one is this?
Okay, so this is the rival, if you like, to the Echo Show and the... Oh, no. No, you know what I've done there? Shush. I'm going to switch that off. The Echo Show and the Google Home Max. It's having this the video showing, displaying on your smart speaker. And I'm sure Paul probably has something like this in his house already, because I know he's that kind of guy.
I might have one or two.
What have you got, Paul?
I've got the Echo Show in my kitchen. I've got the little round thing stuck in a cupboard somewhere. And the Google thing just as a test device.
Okay. So what do you so the usage idea of this is, for example, if you've got a home security set up, maybe you've got Nest Hello set up, then you can stream video from the front door to this smart speaker with a screen, or smart screen with a speaker, have a two-way conversation there with some of them, but not all of them, if I'm right, Paul.
That's right, yeah.
It can also be used in a kitchen environment, so you can watch a video of a recipe being cooked up, for example, or other things. But what do you use yours for, Paul?
The kitchen one, mostly as a timer.
You know, a glorified timer.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, in a way, it's quite nice. I mean, if you're cooking something and you need five different timers for different things, you can set them all and have them all on screen at once, and that's actually quite a good thing. So.
How do you fit all that stuff in your microwave, Paul?
Well, who says I've only got one microwave?
No. And this is basically Facebook. Everyone's seeing this as a big market. I mean, the smart speakers market is obviously big on its own, but people are thinking these the 17th screens in our life, it's going to be a thing. So they're going to be popping up in kitchens all around the country. So, you know, going back to our Microsoft point and the idea of having a Windows PC in every office, you know, the idea here is that we'll have a smart speaker with a screen in every kitchen. So there's a huge opportunity. And now Facebook has jumped in with its portal. I don't know if you've looked at it too much, Paul, in terms of the specs, because we haven't actually seen one yet in the flesh.
I haven't, to be honest. And I mean, specs aren't really important on these things, are they? I mean, they're all, you know, as long as they've got a screen and they've got a speaker and they've got a microphone, what else do they need?
Well, that's the thing. It's the resolution of the screen and it's the quality of the speakers that really matters.
Yeah.
And I believe, you know what, I've closed my window that had all the details, which is very clever of me. I believe it's a 10-inch full HD screen. You know, you're pretty standard going up against the 10-inch Echo Show. Okay, so there's a $199 portal with a 10-inch display, but there's also a Portal Plus with a 15-inch display, presumably with the idea of watching full-on TV as part of that one. And those are going to begin shipping in November. But the news this week has been basically a turnaround. So Facebook initially said that they weren't going to be capturing any data to use for ad targeting, and then they've kind of clarified on that point. And they said, it's classic yes minister, actually. It's, what the Minister of Administrative Affairs meant to say was that we can do it, we don't intend to use it, potentially it could be used. So that's the turnaround that's happened.
I just accept that I'm, you know, anything that I'm using these days that's connected to the internet, so not just web browsers, but any of these devices, I just sort of accept these days that someone's going to be trawling through it looking for things to target ads at me. And you know what? I don't really mind. If I'm, you know, I accept, if you accept that things like Facebook are free and they've got to be funded by ads, I'd much rather see ads that are relevant to me than ads for things that are, you know, things that I'm just not interested in at all.
But the trouble is, you get the ads are just slightly wrong, you know, so that you get the, you know, the UGG boots that you bought last week keep coming up for the following 4 weeks.
Yeah, and if that's the biggest thing in your life to get annoyed about, then it's not really a problem, is it?
I tend to agree with Paul. I mean, I you know, I'm very blasé about my privacy in general. I'm quite happy to, you know, to admit everyone's watching me, and, you know, good luck if you see anything interesting. I doubt you will. But there is a side to, like, the kind of Facebook harvesting information and so on, which I hadn't really thought about. It was brought to my attention recently by, someone. Basically, it was about the sort of political and Brexit-related advertising that was going around back before the referendum and before the election last year. And there was someone linked to a page of videos which were, you know, really super micro targeted, and the likes of you and me wouldn't see them. They were designed to play to very specific audiences. Some of them, I think, were that, so there were some Brexit videos that were aimed at the South Asian community that were saying, you know, if we leave the EU, then we'll be able to take in more people from India, that kind of thing. And I do think that, you know, if the better Facebook gets at, or platforms like Facebook get at, segmenting and understanding and identifying individuals, the harder it becomes for the likes of, you know, for you and me and society in general to actually know what's being said to who, because we just don't see it. We have no opportunity to respond to it, to rebut it, or, you know, to address it, because it's it becomes very personal and limited, and that does concern me a little bit.
Facebook does have a thing where you can click on an ad and you can say, why am I seeing this ad? And it shows you some fairly basic demographic stuff about why it's targeted the ad at you. I mean, it would be nice to see more detail on that.
You, I don't know if you still do this, Paul, in your day job, but you have been involved in on the other side of the fence, haven't you, in terms of...
Absolutely.
So from that point of view, and so what do you do today that is related to that?
We buy ads on Facebook for some of our clients, and it's really nice for targeting. I mean, if it's a local business, say it's a brewery based in the Lake District, and they're running a special offer on brewery tours, we can make sure that the only people that see that, so the only ads we're paying for, are people that live locally. It's great.
Yeah, and presumably you're not yet at the stage where... So here's the point where Portal might come in, because if Portal can see in the background that you've got Bombardier bottles sitting there, then, you know, presumably they could in the future use that information for even closer targeting. So then it raises the question, again, do we care? Does that matter? Is that a breach of our privacy? Or do we think, actually, that's fantastic? I'm far more likely to see that that discounted brewery tour.
It comes down to trust, doesn't it? I mean, I like the idea of an intelligent thing in my kitchen which can say, hey, you know, I've added to your favourite bit of I've added such and such to your shopping list, or I can see that you drink this, so I'm going to let you know there's a discount. But it has to be done, you know, in good faith. And if John Honeyball were on this week, I'm pretty sure he'd have some things to say about that.
Well, I don't understand why you'd buy one of these devices from Facebook. I mean, it seems to offer minimal advantage. Apparently you can do the Facebook Messenger video calls, which I get about once every 6 months. But otherwise, it's basically the Echo Show. It's actually even got Alexa integration. So unless there's some outstanding financial reason to buy this, that they're going to make it £50 or something, I have no idea why you'd even want one.
Well, I had an Echo Show for a while. I was testing one when I did that big roundup of smart speakers about 6 months ago, I guess. And I, like Paul, I put it in the kitchen. Actually, we did really like having it there, and it was a bit of a wrench to send it back. But the trouble with the Echo Show is that Amazon doesn't really support it very well. There's not a lot that you can do with the screen. You can watch Amazon Prime Video. Otherwise, it's mostly just timers. The weather gets, you know, shows up on screen as well as being read out to you. News headlines show up on screen as well as being read out to you. It's not that great. So if Facebook can actually do more with the screen and just make it more of a useful thing, then I'm up for the idea of having a screens device in the kitchen, just not for paying £200 for the not very much that the Amazon one does.
The Amazon one's improving all the... Oh, sorry.
Sorry, I was going to say, I'd use it more in the bedroom, but it's the lack of TV. Easy. The lack of TV stuff is no iPlayer. Amazon's in that spat with YouTube still, so there's no YouTube on the show. I don't know if Facebook supports either of those two, but I don't understand, especially if you've got a 15-inch device, which could be almost a perfect sort of portable bedroom television size, why they don't support more video services on these things. I know Amazon has its own reasons not to, but...
Well, maybe that will come in time. We are seeing slightly better relationships between the big content owners. But have you played... Oh, sorry, my voice went. Have you played much with the Google Home Max, Paul?
No, I haven't.
No. So, but that's got... I would say that's got a slightly better set of integrations. So the way it integrates with your calendar, for example. So, for the sake of argument, let's say you've got a meeting, Barry, at 9:30. It will pop up the directions to that meeting on the device, show you the weather. You know, do you need to bring an umbrella? All that kind of thing. And say, oh, time for you to go, Barry. Finish off that. I don't know. I imagine you're a 4 Weetabix of the morning kind of guy, Barry.
What you're saying, like?
Well, I'm saying nothing. I'm moving
back
on.
Back off.
But and it's also got the very good YouTube integration. So if you think about it, there's so much video produced now on YouTube that you can access. It's kind of ridiculous.
So Home Max is there one with the screen, is it? What's the big speaker one called then?
Oh, Barry.
I thought that was the big speaker one, Home Max.
Oh, how much? No, Google Home Hub, perhaps.
Home Hub, yeah, that's it.
That's the one. That's thanks to Mike Bookham, who suddenly came to my aid there on Mixlr.
This is why I wasn't able to tell you if I actually knew the Facebook portal or not, because all these names are so meaningless. There's no kind of clever logic. If someone said to you it's the Facebook portal, it's the Google Home Hub, you would have absolutely no concept of what sort of product that would be or what it would look like. It's daft.
Well, what do you expect it to say?
Well, I don't know. I mean, if it's a if it's a smart speaker with a screen, then you might call it the screen screeper or something. Just come up with some kind of name that gives you some sense of what it does. Portal and hub are like the laziest, most vague terms you could possibly come up with for any device.
Okay, well,
I think Echo Show is pretty good. It says does what it says on the tin.
A show is a good that's nice and clear.
Yeah.
At least it's got some sort of hint at its talents. The question is, because I'm sure Apple will eventually enter this market, so, what's Apple's going to be called?
HomePod already. Yeah, I think you're right. Apple don't mess around when it comes to names.
They don't. They put silly eyes in the front occasionally, but that's okay.
I'm just imagining if Dell were to enter the market, what would they call it? Like the Vidion XR 900P or something?
No. Be fair. It's Sony who kind of produce these amazing products, like these beautiful headphones that they produce, and then they call them the 1000-XMR3, and it's like what? I just give them a nice name. If it's so difficult to give a product a nice name. Okay, Tim Skipper's come up with a name for it, which is the I Don't Know Why I Need This. So let's move on, shall we, to the next topic. And if someone would be kind enough, it must be you, Darren. What's the next thing for you to talk about?
The next thing for me to talk about, you have been closing your windows, is it's about the EU's... Well, we talked a little while ago about the EU ruling whereby it fined Google an enormous amount of money. Was it like 5 billion euros or something? It was a lot. $5 billion, sorry. Because it held that Google was being anti-competitive by insisting that anybody selling an Android phone that had the Play Store on it also had to bundle the Chrome browser and Google Search. And, I guess the EU was being fairly consistent there because it's slapped Microsoft on the wrist for sort of similar things in the past. I think I remember Barry was a bit cynical about the ruling and the amount of money, but that's probably not a great shock. Google has responded by saying it's going to change the licensing requirements so that in future companies can phone manufacturers can sell Android phones which have the Play Store and don't have Chrome or Google Search, so they could, for example, pre-install Firefox or Bing Search or whatever, and still have the Play Store there, so you can go and download whatever other Android apps you want to. There's going to be some, I don't really understand, there's going to be some licensing. So Google will, I think, I've seen this reported both ways and neither of them really makes sense. I think Google is going to charge handset manufacturers for removing Chrome and the Google search. The logic being that it, you know, there's a value to Google in having you know, these apps already there. It helps helps lock people into their ecosystem. So it doesn't really want that. So if it's going to try and discourage handset manufacturers, and if it can't, it's going to try and get a little bit of a kickback for allowing them to go without. That might well come through the form though of a discount for including them. So it's not, it's just a bit of sleight of hand to make it a bit less than you have to pay us to not have these things. A bit less brazen, but yeah, the upshot is that it's going to be more. It's likely that at some point, somebody, some manufacturer, possibly not your Samsungs and Sonys, but someone is going to come out with a, as I say, a Firefox phone or what have you.
I think the licensing is the other way around, isn't it?
Yes, it is. That's what I'm just about to say. So you're going to get charged for installing Google Maps, and because Google Maps is so popular that, you know, imagine buying an Android phone that hasn't got Google Maps on it. It's a big problem for the vendors, in much the same way as the Windows N versions was the solution to the EU dispute with Microsoft, where they just didn't include the browser or the media player. Yeah, Google's basically taking the Microsoft model and now saying, well, okay, that's fine. And if they want Maps or Chrome, they're going to have to pay for it. So what will eventually happen is that handset manufacturers aren't going to not install these apps, and they're not going to go to another Android fork, almost certainly. So Google, for this solution, is basically going to get more money, which is brilliant.
Okay. Yeah. No, I think I've been misinformed there, but yeah, that doesn't sound right to me. That sounds like seems like it's a problem rather than a solution. Sorry, Paul.
Well, the base version is AOSP, Android Open Source Project, which won't have any of this Google stuff in it, and as the name says, it's open source, so that's going to be free. But I don't think many users are going to accept that, and not just Maps, but things like the Play Store. I mean, if users don't have the Play Store, we're going to end up with a horrible proliferation of other app stores that's going to just become Malware City.
Yeah, the Amazon App Store. I don't think that's Malware City, but I don't like using it. I don't like it in general, but also I don't like the way that my app purchases on my phone and on my normal Android tablet. It knows I own this app, I own that app. If I want to put it on the Fire tablet, I've got to go and buy it again or hack it onto that platform. It's not, you know, it's not good for consumers. And actually, one of the other things which has changed, this is less headline news, but Google has also relaxed its restrictions on who is allowed to distribute forks of Android. Previously, it said if you want to ship your own version of Android, such as Firos on the Amazon tablets, then you're not selling stuff with Google Play and all that. You're not having the official Android as well. You can opt out of the ecosystem, but you can't have it both ways. Now they're stepping back from that, so you could have in this, you know, if it made sense for anyone, Samsung could continue to sell regular Android phones and also sell phones with its own Samsung kind of tweaked with slightly incompatible, slightly crazy version of Android, which again, I don't think that's good for anyone, but it's possible.
So, Paul, your take on this overall, this batch of news, good for the consumer, bad for the consumer?
It's yet to be seen. They're talking about there's going to be this licensing fee. It could be quite substantial. It could be buttons. Who knows?
Well,
and until we know that, we don't really know how it's going to affect the consumer. The other point is that there's all this stuff about For Google, they really want to get Chrome and Android and Google search in front of people. But if you buy a Samsung phone, for example, it'll have Chrome on it, but it'll also have Samsung's browser. And the same with all the other manufacturers. And you're really sort of pushed towards those browsers anyway. Normally, it's you have to actually change a setting to make Chrome your default browser. So, again, I'm not sure how much of a problem Google's trying to solve here.
Well, I don't think Google's trying to solve anything at all. I think it's been almost deliberately awkward because it's been hit by this massive fine. And I think, you know, I think this does again highlight the sort of futility of the EU doing these kind of things, because it's basically just revenue raising. There is nothing else here. It is not the standard practice in the industry is to bundle your own apps with your own platform. The only problem Google's got is it's too big. And so once you get above a certain size, the EU decides that certain behaviors that are perfectly acceptable for Apple are not acceptable for Google simply because it's got more customers. That makes no sense to me. It should be the behavior that's the problem, not the scale, your company's scale. And having to behave in a different way just because you had the misfortune to be better selling than another company is that doesn't make any sense to me.
This is an argument we've been having since the original Microsoft antitrust case back in about 2001 or whenever the hell it was. And I've got to say, I mean, I hear what you're saying, but I think it is a fact of the market that a small company behaving one way isn't a problem and an enormous behemoth behaving the exact same way is a problem. It's an annoying grey area, and I think it is, you know, I could certainly see, you know, CEOs or whatever saying it's a bit unfair because no one flags up. No one says, by the way, next year you're going to have to change your practices, otherwise we're going to hit you. You get to that position just by doing what you've always been doing, then suddenly, you know, they turn around and say you're in the wrong. But I don't think we can, well, I don't agree that it's fine for Google to bundle and leverage and push just because it's all right for smaller companies to do the same thing.
But they do. I mean, this is, every company does it, and there's no, if, as you say, if there was this sort of cutoff point where, you know, you suddenly had to change behavior, I don't think even that would change the way they distributed software from the start. No, every company just now sees this as a cost of doing business, and Google will suck up the $3 billion fine and put out these silly versions for a couple of years, and then the whole issue would die away in the same way it did with Microsoft. It changes nothing fundamentally about the market at all. The EU is not providing a remedy for consumer competition in the slightest, in the same way it didn't provide any remedy with the browser ballot or the N versions for Windows Media Player. It's just revenue raising.
You say that. I mean, I don't know. The browser ballot is a difficult one to argue because, you know, I'm not using Internet Explorer now. You're not using Internet Explorer. The
kind of nothing to do with the browser ballot. Nothing to do with the browser ballot.
It's a complex question. Well, yes, but maybe there was an environment in which Chrome could, you know, which helped Chrome grow. I mean, I do see your point that the EU is not writing its own browser and saying this is a completely free open browser which you can use instead. It's kind of it's saying the market will solve this problem when the problem is itself the market. But
EU should say to all phone manufacturers, you cannot enforce that your software, you have to run your own browser on your own OS. That's the way to solve the problem. But wait until people get to the point where they're so large that the market is effectively, the competition's gone in anyway, is pointless.
What do you really feel? Paul, which side are you falling on this particular argument?
I don't know, to be honest. It's, you can see arguments
on both sides. Paul, for Christ's sakes.
it's one of those things where you can see arguments on both sides.
I don't think you understand the purpose of the podcast. It's to take a completely invalid point of view and then argue it until, you know, everyone just tears their hair out and leaves.
Yeah. Okay, I think it's great.
That's it. That's what we're looking for. All right, let's move on to the next story. And this is you, Barry. And that's me just, I've lost my place again. Yes, well, this is one thing that's close to your heart, really, because Adobe has announced that it's brought Photoshop to the iPad. So first of all, what's your reaction to that news?
At last. Yes, this is, Adobe's been promising a full version of Photoshop for iPad Pro devices for some time. And at its conference this week, actually showed it off. A few lucky journalists got a chance to play a bit. And from the videos and whatever I've seen, it looks pretty good. Sort of rewind here. Adobe's sort of been forced into doing this pretty much by Serif. And Serif's products, Affinity Photo, and Affinity Designer on the iPad are excellent, both very comparable in terms of features to the desktop software. And both of those apps are pretty cheap. I think they're 20 quid each at full price. They're often discounted in the app stores. And so I think Adobe has seen that and has had pressure on it to bring its own apps to the iPad or face, you know, losing that market. And it's taken its time, but from the demos that I've seen, it looks to have done a fairly good job. But obviously we'll have to wait and see until the full apps arrive.
I don't think it's going to be the full experience, though, is it?
It doesn't. Well, it's at the moment, so some of the demos, they were feature restricted, so there are bits of the interface that were sort of grayed out still, whenever. I think there will still be some power features that won't make it to the iPads. A lot, maybe some of the 3D stuff that you get in full-blown Photoshop. So no, I don't think it's going to be have complete feature parity. But I think it will be good enough, from what I could see. For you know, for your average designer or illustrator or someone doing some retouched on photographs, I think it'd be fine.
Yeah,
and I was able to understand the appeal of Lightroom on the iPad, but I've got to say, I mean, for what I use Photoshop for, I just cannot imagine that a finger is ever going to be precise enough. It's just
Well, that's why you have an Apple Pencil, young Darian.
Yes, that makes sense.
Well, this is the thing, isn't it? It's no need now to have a separate graphics tablet sitting there, you know, probably unused 95% of the time. You can draw directly on screen. And the idea, they've brought in this new format as well of cloud PSD.
Mm.
Yes. So, and then now that's where things are starting to get... I mean, again, Adobe... we've talked about this before in sense of the competition and how Adobe continues to manage to fight off people like Serif. And one of the reasons it does in a number of apps is because of its file format. So we talked a couple of weeks ago about how Serif is launching a rival to InDesign. But when most of the publishing industry works in InDesign files, then that's pretty difficult for an outsider to crack. So Adobe may be here seeing that its market's been eroded away by these other apps, is introducing its own file format across the, you know, for its apps, and it'd be interesting to see if that, because it, you know, Photoshop and the majority of the files you work on in Photoshop and Illustrator aren't specific, they're standard JPEG, PNGs, whatever, TIFFs. It'd be interesting to see if Adobe can make its own file format stick in this space.
Well, what they're actually arguing, though, is that the file system becomes irrelevant. They talked, didn't they, about if you think about what a Photoshop file is or an InDesign file, it's a collection of things. You've got a font in there. You've got images, linked images in there. You've got text. You might have video, you know, these days. So it's like a container for a load of other assets that feed into it. So it's going to be very difficult for anyone else to fight against that, because that container will undoubtedly be Adobe's.
Yeah, perhaps. I think, I don't know how much that will impact out the way people work. I think people will still, certainly in you know, illustration and photography, I think people will still work with the standard file formats. I don't know if this is a massive threat to that.
It looks to me as if they've taken PSD, as Tim says, it's a container with lots of stuff in it. They've split the different streams out, and then they're syncing those individually to the cloud. So if you update a bit of text, you're not sending the whole file up to the Adobe Cloud Service. You're just sending that one little bit. Which is neat as far as it goes.
Yeah, and it certainly helps with those workflows if you're out and about with your iPad on the train or something and you're, you know, updating on 4G. I can see the benefits of that.
Yeah.
When you come to the final export, is that going to make a huge difference?
Yeah.
I don't know.
The other thing with all of these cloud-based services, there's two ways of working, really. If you think about something saved onto Google Drive, for example, just a text document, and you save a change and someone else is working on it, you end up with clashy versions. Mm. Whereas if you use something like Google Docs, then you can see the edits each of you are making in turn. Now, if that worked in Photoshop, if you could have two or three different people all working on the same thing at the same time, that would be fantastic. But I don't think that's where they're going.
Yeah, I'm always in two minds about that kind of thing. I'm never sure. I think it's very – there are very specific business cases where that would work great and others where that would be a complete nightmare. So I guess it depends how those projects are split up. It does
already happen in Adobe software, because you can use InCopy, for example, at the same time that someone else is InCopy to write that, to cut the story, whatever, and then you use InDesign. A designer is using that separately to actually design the elements. So there is that synchronization that's already happening. So it's not within, I can definitely imagine that occurring for across Photoshop as well. Mm. But what do we think about this idea that they also put forward? I'll open this up to the floor. You can start, Darian. The death of file formats, is that realistic? Are we reaching the end of file formats? Will we look back in 10 years and say, why on earth did we bother with this?
You've kind of sprung this on me. I haven't actually read what they were saying, but I mean, in principle, it makes perfect sense that, I mean, this is the XML dream, isn't it? That all you really need is just one way of describing a thing, and then you have the thing, and there's no reason at all. I mean, there are reasons why JPEG is different to TIFF, but there's no particular reason why we can't have a canonical, just a non-lossy version of a picture and be able to open it in any app in the, any app at all which works with pictures. This actually reminds me of the Amiga, the good old days of AmigaOS, where there was a thing called can't remember what it was called now. I was going to say file types. That's not right. But anyway, the operating system had its own library of file handlers, and any app could open an image or a text file or a sound if the right file handler was installed system-wide. And that was a really nice idea that worked very cleanly. And of course, as most of us did in the 90s, I had to hop onto Windows because the Amiga died a death, and it was one of the many things I missed greatly. And we still don't have anything that smart. So I think, you need to have some sort of file formats have to exist to an extent so that there is a standard way that any program can know this is a picture, this is text, and do the right thing with it. But yeah, there's too many of them.
Yes, but it's not just file formats, it's how we organize them. So this idea of dragging a document to your desktop, for example, which Microsoft tried to get rid of via the form of shortcuts, that's what, that it seems to be in people's targets.
Now, are you talking about a file system or file formats?
Well, okay, so what he said, this is me quoting the Adobe, Scott Belsky of Adobe, and he said, one of the things we're going to have to overcome is our obsession with the organization of files in the desktop file folder format. We have a lot of customers who live by that, but I think we're finding some creative ways to bridge people over to this new world. In order to have a multi-surface, first-class experience of a product like Photoshop, you do need to abandon the constraints of the traditional file system.
So he's talking file system, not formats.
Yeah, sorry, I probably introduced that incorrectly. But that's what he's talking about.
Well, they're kind of similar things, though, aren't they? Because, I mean, the file format is to do with the storage and the representation of the data. And if that moves off your system, then you don't really need to own, you don't need to know about how it's stored. You just need to be able to get access to it. Sorry.
You've got to be able to find it, and that's the tricky bit. I think, I've heard these kind of pronouncements before, and you're right, Microsoft had nibbles at it in the past, but it's, I always end up coming back to folders and subfolders, because especially if you're working collaboratively, most of the magazines that we produce now are produced in either Google Docs or Dropbox. And I know PC Pro does, and the other projects I work on have tons of folders and subfolders and folders for proofs and folders for photos and photos, folders for copy, because you need to be able to know where to find stuff, and it needs to be neat and ordered. If it's just all in one mass. You don't know what issue it's for, or what section it's for, what page it's for, and who's looking after this. Is this ready to go? So if they want that to work, if they want to get rid of the file system completely, they need to have a much better way of managing workflow from beginning to end, with better file tagging and stuff like that. You can't just bung stuff into one continuous blob and hope it all comes out in the right order.
But that's a good example. But so, for example, I have probably about half the magazine now is produced using Google Docs, actually, the document creation software to do this. So that's how we rewrite everything. But those still sit within a folder structure. You know, as you say, Barry, you know, this there's a folder that says this is ready for the designers to design it. There's a folder that says, you know, this is raw copy still to be edited. And that's very helpful to have. But the actual thing sitting there in my Windows Explorer, it is effectively a shortcut to something sitting on the cloud somewhere. It's an illusion, I suppose, is what it comes down to for my sake. So we're already edging there.
Yeah, it's all about the metadata, isn't it? I mean, it's about how you present, how the user sees, what the user sees and how it's organized. I mean, the actual folder structure is itself, I believe, a bit of a fiction. I mean, obviously, the files aren't inside folders when they're on the disk. They just have a thing at the start that says, this is where I'm notionally located. And as long as, you know, if we could find a better way of like, metadata being applied to files automatically, so we don't have to spend our time cataloging things. I do love the idea that we could move to a system where I could say I want to see a window containing all the files relating to issue 291 of PC Pro. Actually, I just want to see the ones which are for me to edit. Actually, I just want to see the ones which are image files, and have that all come up, you know, nice and quickly and cleanly in real time. I mean, it's kind of antediluvian the way that we still have to click to go into folder, subfolder, you know, go and find things. Oh, it's not in here. Let's go and reverse back. And oh no, actually, maybe it's in Dropbox rather than Google Drive. Let's go and search the other folder tree. That, you know, I can see it. I can see it happening. But we would really need a smarter, better way of the computer or the applications knowing more about what you're working on, so that you can have these much more flexible views.
And operating systems do have tags. I mean, macOS, for example. You know, there are. Hmm. You know, it has got that tagging system, but it's just, it's a housekeeping thing, isn't it? People just don't end up tagging things, and you know, having something in a folder, you'll always find it. Whereas if someone's forgotten to tag something, yeah, good luck.
Yeah,
yeah. I remember years ago when we were looking at a new content management system for the magazine, and it was all based on tags, and it died a death within about a fortnight because nobody tagged stuff up. When you've got people have to manually do stuff like that, it falls away because nobody has the time. It's just never going to work. Unless there's, as Darren says, some degree of automation, it's never going to work.
Well, it's an extra step, isn't it?
Something you're not used to. And it's just more work. And people tag things differently. You know, they had slightly different names for the same thing, and it just all falls apart.
Yeah,
I think that we're being a bit harsh on a system which I just, you know, kind of plucked out of thin air. I think it could work. I'm more optimistic.
Okay, all right. Let's park that one there. We'll come back to the future and sort that all out. That'll be for the next podcast. So just before we move on to the hot hardware of the week. I should say the new issue of PC Pro is out. Let's see.
Is it good?
It's a mate. Paul. Okay, so Paul. So in case that, I should probably say, if you're a subscriber and you've not received a couple of any issues recently, then do chase up, because we have had some problems with our the company that sorts that out. So you may have found that your subscription has been automatically lapsed when you didn't want it to be. So if it hasn't landed on your doorstep, that's probably why, and I advise you to just get in touch with them. But yes, Paul, it looks amazing. And I'm just turning to your column now. Let's see, what did you talk about, Paul? You talked about it's great to see a company still supporting and continuing to develop a 5-year-old product. Oh yeah, you talked about your your scanner.
I did. I talked about a five-year-old scanner that at the time was brilliant. You know, Fujitsu was still developing it. And in between me writing that and that column hitting the people's mats for the subscription and arriving in the shops, they've released an update to it, a new version.
Yeah. But then do you want to just explain why you're using it and how you're using it?
To try and become paperless. I was looking for a scanner that would, you could feed stuff into it and it would just squirt it out onto the cloud. So no PC involved, no local RC, OCR. So I could just put all my old bank statements and letters and whatever through this fairly quick scanner and just then shred the paperwork. Yep. And it works really well.
Yeah, so you can find out exactly how Paul does that. So if in this current issue, which goes on sale today, on the front, it's got a big VPN. Which one can you trust? And Barry, you looked after that feature.
Yeah, so we've got reviews of lots of the leading VPN software out there, either desktop or mobile in some instances. But looking at a variety of factors, and you know, it's a bit of an eye-opener for me, to be honest, because I've never really got too deep into VPNs before. But once you start digging around and find that every provider has different rules about whether they inspect your files or not, or where they're kept, or you know, the amount of bandwidth that you get for free before you start being charged, and the different streaming rates that you get if you're trying to access services like iPlayer or Netflix remotely. It's a really good read, actually, in terms of finding out which suits particular tasks the best.
Yeah, one VPN definitely doesn't fit all. And also, as you know, we had a separate discussion, didn't we, Paul, amongst all the real worlders in terms of what exactly a VPN means and how it's so different for different people.
Yeah, I mean, there's the old school VPN, which we've all been using to get back into our offices to, you know, to look at servers and look at, you know, secret documents and things like that, which is very different to the consumer version of a VPN, which is to hide your porn habits.
thanks for just drilling down to the nub of the matter there.
Well, someone's got to say it.
And also, he said, quickly moving on, we basically had all the mainstream tablets on test as well. So that includes the new Surface Go. You can see how that performed compared to everyone else. And you can see which ones other than iPad actually won awards. There was one from Huawei, which leads me nicely on to the hot hardware of the week, which is because we had a huge glitzy launch at, can I say that, about XL? I was there on Tuesday, and it was so crowded. It was crazy. There were, you know what an XL hall is like. And it was just full of journalists from around the world watching the president of Huawei on stage. And you just kind of think, in the space of 5 years, and you'll appreciate this, Paul, Huawei's gone from basically an infrastructure name, so only known to those in the back end. It's been a long-term smartphone maker, but for other companies. And now it's huge and getting
absolutely
all this interest.
And it amazes me that these phone launches are still such a big event too.
Yeah, well, but they're certainly making a lot of fuss about this particular phone. So I've had it for a couple of days. I'm still, I would say, very much at the beginning of my playing with it. But I have some facts and figures if you are interested in such things. Are you interested in such things?
Absolutely.
Okay, so basically, this has got the Kirin 980 inside this processor, and that isn't supposed to just make things go slightly faster, although naturally it's a very, very slick interface, but of course it's going to be a slick interface. It's also, it's also meant to be, you know, it meant to be a very, very fast gaming system, and my early signs are that is absolutely true. But the idea as well is that it's got this AI chip that will help you to do some quite impressive things on the fly. So, for example, the demo they talked about on stage, in which I tried to replicate, where they had someone you'd have a frame. So you have your frame and you have your person in the frame, but you've got all the background as well, which isn't so interesting. So rather than shoot all of that in color, what it does is it isolates the person and using supposedly this AI and produces, records that video live. And it is amazing. Actually, it does work. I don't know how it does it, but you can record this scene where you as a subject are there completely separated from the background. I don't know whether that's anything someone would be actually interested in, but that's quite a stunning change.
It's not a reason to buy a phone, is it?
Not unless you are planning to shoot a film. But I suppose what it does show is that these things are they're so intelligent now. You know, these things in your pocket, they can, if you can think back to phones where they had, you know, like a 3-megapixel camera and everything was very blurry. And now Michael Deere is asking on Mixler, sorry, is this a camera or a phone? Well, it's getting very blurred. Is this a camera or is it a phone? On the back of this thing,
I hope it's not getting blurred.
No, okay, bad choice of words. On the back of this thing, it's got three different lenses.
It's like laser blades, isn't it?
It is getting a bit like that. But the idea being that you can also have incredibly wide aperture. So I'm going to quote this off the top of my head, but something like 26 to 300 mil. Does that sound about right to you, Barry?
Well, that's not aperture, that's focal length, but I get very annoyed with mobile phone reviewers when they start talking about aperture, because most of them don't know what they're talking about.
Like me, for example. Yeah, because you're actually, but Barry is a photographer, and so I wish there was a way we could share this, Barry. Actually, I'm seeing you next Thursday, aren't we? I'll hand it over to you then. But it is an impressive piece of technology, undoubtedly. And yes, to Michael's point, I'd say it is half camera and half phone in some ways.
But many of these phones have got the same camera hardware in them. It's the software that's different between them.
I don't know if that's true in this one's case. And this has got all the specs you would possibly imagine them, so I'm not going to bombard you with them, but this one's got I think it's 22 megapixels is the main one, and actually we all know how misleading megapixels are, because that's not the point really, but it is a staggering amount of technology packed into this this tiny phone. All right, do you want to ask me some other questions about it? And
battery.
Okay, it's got a 4200 okay. milliamp hour battery in it.
All right, that's quite respectable.
It is, but of course, Paul, our resident physics man, yeah, as I like to call him, will say, well, actually, that's meaningless. It's got 4200 milliamp hours. They should be measuring watt hours.
Exactly.
Would you say that, Paul?
Yeah. I would say that. I mean, the interesting thing about the battery in this is the charging, isn't it? It's got wireless charging, but it's the first phone I've seen that's got two-way wireless charging, so you can actually use the phone to charge something else.
Yes, and they're quite cheeky, actually. In the presentation, they showed it back-to-back with an iPhone XS. Saying if you need to charge a friend's phone, it can do it. So the other thing it's got two other things which are quite interesting from as interesting as battery technology can be. It's got this adaptive learning, which is built into Android 9 Pi, where the idea is that it adapts to how you use the phone to eke out more battery life. I've not used it long enough to say whether or not that works. But it's also got this fast charging if you actually use the supplied charger. And it's impressive to behold. I didn't time, actually. I probably should have done. But I think it went from about 30% when I started charging it this morning to about 98% in... It felt like minutes. It's probably about 20 minutes. But you actually, it's got this nifty interface where it shows you how quickly it's charging. And it's the fastest charging I've seen anyway. It's really you just need to plug it in for a while, and you'll have enough battery life to keep you going for the rest of the day.
Does the phone get warm?
While still charging?
Yeah.
I didn't notice that. Maybe it does. But no, I didn't. Because, of course, I just left it there. Well, I wasn't really picking it up whilst it was charging.
So no flames then?
There were no flames. It does get a bit warm if you start to push it in benchmarks and that kind of thing. But, that's typical fare, isn't it, for a phone?
Yeah.
Okay, ask me another question, guys.
Tell us about the fingerprint sensor.
Okay, so it's the first time I've seen... Is it the first one, actually, Paul? I haven't checked this. Because I think it's been talked about for a while, but having a fingerprint sensor built in under the screen, if you like. Yeah. And so you can't press anywhere. But what happens, for example, I just switched it off. And then if I go to flick it on again, well, actually, facial recognition has kicked in. But if that wasn't working, then it would show me a thumbprint, a fingerprint, just about a third of the way up the corner. And so rather than pressing on a dedicated fingerprint sensor, you basically press on this image that appears on the screen, and then it lights up in a very kind of futuristic way. And lo and behold, you tap and you get into your into Android.
Does that result in good, huge fingerprints?
Answering Paul's question, because that I only could hear that one.
Sorry.
There are no fingerprints on the front. I wouldn't really say fingerprints are a problem on the shiny back either. It's there's no problem from that point of view. I did find it took longer to set up than normal fingerprints. It wanted me to press on the edges and all this kind of thing, so it was more fussy than previous fingerprint readers. And initially, actually, I don't know if it's my technique or it, but initially it took me a while to make it work properly.
Well, presumably there's got to be a two-step process there then, hasn't there? Because with the fingerprint reader on my phone, you press that and it wakes the phone. But you presumably have to wake the phone. It then tells you where to put your fingerprint and then you unlock. So it's slowing things down, right?
Well, it becomes, if you think about how you hold your camera, if you think about how you hold your phone, Barry, so I'm holding it now in my right hand, and just resting it quite naturally, where my thumb would press down, that's where you press it. But to be honest with you...
Yeah, but if your phone's on standby, not lit up, you have to wake it up to get the screen to show you where to put your fingerprint, yeah?
Oh, I see what you mean. I'm just kind of making it go... I pressed it, and then I had to adjust it slightly. So I guessed where it would go, and it just had to adjust it. But honestly, Barry, the facial recognition works so quickly that actually most of the time, I would say it's very much the secondary way to unlock the phone. And the main point about it is, do you really want it on the back of the phone? Do you really want to have lose actual image space to a fingerprint reader, beneath the main screen? That's the real.
No, I want a sudden home button. Stop taking home buttons off phones, you bastards.
I know what you mean, but it's there and it's built into the interface. The home button is still there, but it's just part of the screen now. I just think it's something that you get used to quite quickly.
Yeah.
So from that point of view, it's fine. Okay, I'm aware of a slight lack of time. Do you want me to give you some benchmark scores? We're not really interested in that kind of stuff.
Can we talk about the storage quickly?
Oh, yes. Okay, good point. Thank you. Yes, we can. So this has got a new format called Nano SD. That's right, isn't it, Paul?
That's right. And that sort of sounds like a standard, but it's proprietary.
Yeah, that's right. It's proprietary to to Huawei. And so you've got the SIM tray, and it's basically got two sides to it. And when you unlock this, slide out the SIM tray, and you can either put in two SIMs or you can put in this nano SD card. Which, as you say, is proprietary. I haven't seen any prices for any memory yet, but yeah. it's going to be like Sony, isn't it? Where they charge basically double the market price.
It just seems bonkers to me. And a micro SD card is so small. Is there really no room to get one of those on that tray?
Yeah, there would have been. I'm sure they could have done it. So exactly why they've done that, I'm not entirely sure. Make money?
Could be.
They've got to pay for flying a press over to Excel somewhere, haven't they?
Yeah.
And that does bring us to price. Actually, just talk to yourselves for a second, because I cleverly put the my printouts with all the pricing information out there. I haven't managed to get a British price out of them yet.
There's pre-release pricing is now on Carphone Warehouse. Not that you've been boring me, but I just had a very quick look, so I can tell you how much it costs.
Go on, then.
It's... Oh, you're going to laugh. It's £899.
Yeah.
If I'm looking at the right thing.
Is that the Mate 20 or the Mate 20 Pro? Because I've been talking about the Mate 20 Pro.
Yes, that's the Pro.
That's the Pro. Okay, so £899. And for that, presumably, you get a 6 gigabytes of RAM and 128 gigabytes of storage.
That's exactly what you get.
Yeah, okay. If it's £899... then that's considerably less than their official press release states, because that MSRP of €1,049.
Hmm.
So yeah.
Well, to be fair, the euro is not what it once was, or to be fair, the pound is not what it once was. That is £920, so it's not too far off. But yes,
so
but still
for your. £899, this is just on Carphone Warehouse. You also get a free smartwatch and wireless charger. They don't say which smartwatch, but... You know,
yeah, it's their new smartwatch, which isn't Android Wear. They've gone to their own proprietary operating system for some odd reason.
Well, there'd be several reasons, but that's pretty beyond the... I'm looking at the time already.
Yes.
But yes, that uses LightOS, which is open source, I believe, rather than being totally proprietary. But, yeah, it means you can't... you'll struggle to get Fitbit working for it, certainly immediately. So,
Stupid.
You have to question the point of that. But it does. You do also get much better battery life. So, you know, swings, roundabouts, etc. All right, let's take some votes. So in terms of benchmarks, yes, predictably, it's fast. It's not as fast in Geekbench as others, but 3,500-ish for single core, just under 10,000 for multi-core. So that's the fastest Android phone we've seen, but that is still below the Apple, the top Apple iPhones. And then you've got things like GFX Bench as well. I've benched it in so far. Decent scores, but not exceptional. You know, it's not going to blow your mind, but it's a fast everyday, run any game you like at the moment and it will be able to cope with it. So I'll give you a sample. Manhattan 3.1, that got 48 frames per second. Off the top of my head, I think the iPhone got 60 frames per second. So, you know, it's pretty darn quick. Is it the very, very fastest? I wouldn't say it probably is. So do we have any questions before we cast our votes?
Hurry up, Tim.
Okay. All right, then. If you could cast your votes now on Mixlr, that'd be great. Barry, do you want to be brief?
Yes, no.
Okay. Darian?
I'm with Barry.
No. Okay. What do you think, Paul? You can be a bit more measured as I wait for all the people to...
Yeah, for me, I think the memory knackers it for me.
The proprietary nature of the memory.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so, and actually, as I look along the cast of votes, so just to balance things out, I'm going to say it's, I'm going to give it I'll give it hot just to make it more lukewarm overall. I think it's a great product, and it's a lovely phone. And I do think the camera technology is amazing. They're asking one heck of a lot of money for it. And that's actually a lot of the feedback that we're getting on Mixlr. So, for example, Mike Bookham is saying, if it is in a 400 to 500 price range, it might be hot. Well, you don't know. It might drop down to that price. So keep your eye on that. These launch prices, as Paul will know, they tend to, unless you're Apple, they do tend to drop quite a lot, don't they?
Very much so, yeah.
So it can often just be worth waiting. But as I read through the comments on Mixlr, I'm struggling for... Well, I've got Zed Morrow saying hot if it's between 600 and 800, so that just veers towards the not. Stewie, too, very much a not. Zed, Tim Skipper, freezing. Dom Liu, cold. And Michael Deere, agreeing with Mr. Bookham, too expensive. All right. Thank you very much, everyone, for taking part in this week's podcast. I hope you enjoyed it, Paul.
Very much so. Good.
Excellent. All right. And hopefully it was vaguely enjoyable to listen to as well. I'm sure you'll let us know. Thanks, guys. Until our next podcast in 2 weeks' time, it's goodbye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.